Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm going to introduce someone who I believe represents those values stunningly well. Has extraordinary experience and extraordinary track record. And someone I've known a long time and have known for a long time, I shared values with and shared a common commitment to public service with.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we will jump right into this new week with a very special first guest. You heard Mayor-elect de Blasio begin the introduction there. The incoming first deputy mayor of New York City, the man de Blasio has named to be his second in command on almost everything, Anthony Shoris. He has broad experience in government and the private sector. He was an architect of Mayor Ed Koch's affordable housing program. He was executive director of the Port Authority under Governor Spitzer. He's currently an executive at the NYU Langone Medical Center and much more. And we're establishing the line. We have seem to have a little trouble with the line, unfortunately, with Anthony Shoris, so he'll be right there. So we'll talk to Anthony Shoris right now. After that this morning, Molly Ball from The Atlantic on an event called Ready for Hillary that Molly covered last week. And on the Senate and House Republicans weirdly trading places right now on which ones are the hardline conservatives threatening a government shutdown. You're used to this being the Tea Party faction of the House, right? Well, the House pretty overwhelmingly passed this budget compromise between Paul Ryan and Patty Murray the other day. It's the Senate vote tomorrow that is in serious doubt. So we may have a government shutdown cliff coming at New Year's anyway, but at the hands of the Senate Republicans, not the House Republicans this time. And we have Senator Jeffrey Klein of the New York State Senate from the Bronx today, leader of the so-called independent Democrats who are keeping the Republicans in power in the New York State Senate. He's got a package of proposals for 2014, does Jeffrey Klein, that includes 6 weeks of paid family leave and prepaid college at today's tuition rates. But will his Republican partners go along? And what did Nelson Mandela mean to young South Africans who grew up apartheid? What did Nelson Mandela mean to the generation that only knew him as an old man? So we'll talk about what they ironically call the Mandela generation in South Africa today, also known as the born free generation. Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop with a proposal to use law enforcement's buying power to encourage responsible gun manufacturing. And reasons to love New York today. You know that annual New York Magazine edition? It's out for the end of 2013. Reasons to love New York. So we'll hear some of New York Magazine's and we'll hear some of yours. But now we have Anthony Shoris with us, the first deputy mayor nominee, or I guess he doesn't need to be confirmed by city council like they would have to get Senate confirmation in Washington. So he's more than a nominee. He's the appointee of Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio. And Mr. Shoris, thanks so much for coming on today and congratulations on this pivotal new position.
Thanks, Brian, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk to you this morning.
Are you excited?
I am excited, absolutely. I think it's potentially a pivotal moment in New York, so I'm excited to be part of Bill's incoming team.
We're still having some phone problems. You're kind of dropping in and out, so we'll see if we can get this solidified on our end. Otherwise, we'll take a break and we'll get you back up on more solid footing. In your introductory news conference, you emphasize the values, and we heard it in the clip that we played a minute ago of the mayor-elect introducing you, the values that you and he have long shared. Do you see values driving your administration in a different way from the Bloomberg administration?
Well, look, I think one thing Bill made clear throughout his campaign is he has a pretty strong perspective on where the city needs to go. I think it's his perspective, a unique perspective that he's bringing, and I think it was a perspective that was endorsed by an enormous majority of New Yorkers who I think want to see, after we've had to deal with a lot of other issues, that now it's time to turn to deal with issues of inequality and a lack of opportunity in New York. And that manifests itself in lots of ways, Brian. It manifests itself in the need for more affordable housing. It means access to better health care and broader access to health care. It means a pre-K and an after-school system that is available to all New Yorkers. And it means jobs for people who've been left behind and too often left out of the economic growth the city's seen. So it's a pretty big agenda. It's a pretty exciting agenda. I think it's a different agenda that Bill's bringing to the table. I think that's what New Yorkers called out for, and that's what we're hoping to deliver.
What will you do on day one? Have you and the mayor-elect decided on any symbolic or substantive acts that you'll take right away?
No, I mean, honestly, we haven't sort of done day one theater. I think what we're really focused on is trying to, right now, put the team in place, because you can't run the plays without the team. We're working hard on putting together the right group of people who really share his commitment to those values, who reflect the city that we're all part of, and who fundamentally are going to have the kind of drive and effectiveness and appetite for innovation that's going to take to realize some of those visions in the, you know, pretty tough financial context that we're walking into.
Listeners, we have Anthony Shores with us. He's the incoming first deputy mayor under Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio. You can post your questions at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show and your comments on inequality. You're fighting global economics. You're fighting paralyzed national politics. Can a city fundamentally change the course of equality and inequality for its residents? Can any city?
Look, it's no question, Brian, the point you're raising, which is that this is a global issue and certainly a national issue, and there is no question no mayor can do this alone. One of the things that makes this a promising moment for New York is that there's a pretty good alignment right now between the president, as we saw on Friday when he brought the new mayors in, and Bill was clearly among the leaders of that group. We have strong interest and support for that agenda from a new city council, which is coming in, and I think we're going to see continued support for that from our senators and our governor. So there's actually some unique alignment right now around the need to address some of those issues. Now, look, we'd be foolish to say that one mayor turns around something that's taken generations to make a problem in this country, and we're modest enough about that. On the other hand, if we don't start in New York to demonstrate that great cities, which after all have been the engines for innovation in America for time immemorial, and in particular this city, can demonstrate that they can really change that direction, not solve all the problems, that's obviously, as you say, a much more fundamental issue, but change direction and course, and to start really by talking about it and recognizing how many people are now not participating in the growth and prosperity that we see in some parts of the city. If we can just start by being honest and talking about those issues, I think we can begin to change that direction. It'll take a lot more than the mayor, for sure, but it starts right here at City Hall.
Let me ask you a kind of conceptual question about that. Is inequality really even the issue, or is it the strength and size of the middle class and upward mobility for the poor? In other words, do you care if the richest to poorest ratio has become insanely high, a gazillion to one compared to past generations, inequality per se, as we know it has, if the poor have real opportunity and the middle class is large?
Look, Brian, this is not an issue of pitting one group against another. What we're trying to say here, though, is that for people who have been successful, for people who have achieved a lot in the system that's here now, it's time, we think, for them to help solve some of the issues and address some of the inequality that's affected the people you're talking about, the low-income folks, the folks who've been left behind in the system, and the struggling, increasingly struggling middle class. So it doesn't mean that we're asking people to give away the growth and opportunity and success that New York's had. Nobody would be in favor of that. But we do think people have a responsibility to each other. And New York's always been a place where I think people have recognized that responsibility to each other. New York's always had a progressive business community as much as it's had been a progressive city. And I think there's more recognition of that than sometimes people give credit for. And so I'm actually optimistic that a fair number of people you'll see over the next few years will come around to recognizing the notion that, sure, we want success and we want people to do well and we want our economy to grow. And we also want people to recognize the needs of their fellow New Yorkers and to contribute to that. And that's part of why Bill proposed not just a pre-K plan, but a pre-K plan that was funded with a very modest increment of additional resources from the people who've done the best. That's part of what's glued New York together, and that's part of the issue of inequality. So, look, fundamentally, I don't disagree with you, Brian. We need to help the people who have been left behind, and we need to strengthen the middle class. It's not going to be at the expense of our growth and opportunity, but I think it is going to require a recognition of our social obligation to each other.
Incoming first Deputy Mayor Anthony Shores, my guest on WNYC. I want to play a clip of Mayor-elect de Blasio speaking movingly last week and at some length about the series in the New York Times about that 12-year-old girl in a homeless shelter, Dasani, and some of the issues that raised. This is about a minute and a quarter of Mayor-elect de Blasio. And then I want to ask you what you think the administration might change with respect to specific Bloomberg administration homeless policies. So here's the mayor-elect.
The story of this one young lady, Dasani, I can tell you, having crisscrossed the city and talked to all sorts of people in the course of this week, that it's been gripping to a lot of people. It's been gripping to all of us who are part of this transition. It's not that we didn't know these problems existed before, but to see them through the eyes of one child and one family brings it home in a very forceful way. And to hear the challenges that this family has faced in a shelter, living in a way that is not acceptable for any New Yorker to live, literally just blocks away from million-dollar brownstones. If you ever needed an illustration of what the Tale of Two Cities is all about, there you have it. We are simply not going to allow this kind of reality to continue. The sad fact is that some of our city's policies and some of our approach over the years has not helped people to transcend their challenges. In some ways, unfortunately, some of these policies, some of these approaches have kept people stuck in place. And we're not going to let down Dasani or any young woman or any young man like her. It's our job to do better for them.
Mayor-elect de Blasio last week, his first deputy mayor appointee with us right now, Anthony Shores. And are there specific policies that you could name that you and the mayor-elect would like to change in regard to what Mr. Blasio said in that clip?
Well, look, I can tell you one thing, Brian. Bill was incredibly saddened reading that story. He brought that story up every single day that I was with him last week, how just profoundly, you know, first of all, as a parent, and second of all, as a New Yorker, how mortified he was that anyone could live like that in those conditions in New York City. So, look, are there things to do? There's really at two levels. Sure, first off, there's some immediate things. There's going to be changes at the Auburn shelter. I think he made that clear at the press conference where he announced my colleague Lillian Barris Paoli as the deputy mayor for Health and Human Services, that we're going to be looking hard at making changes in that particular facility. A little more generally, it's also clear that we're going to want to revisit the question of transitional vouchers for homeless families so we can get people out of that kind of congregate shelter into housing so they can get themselves on their feet. But I think the more, even more general issue beyond that particular shelter and even that particular program, mm-hmm. is what Dasani really illustrated is a series of integrated initiatives that we're going to have to take around housing, around health care, around education, even in areas farther afield than that all have to be aligned around the issue of changing the quality of life for people who are that far, being left that far out of our system. So that means thinking about the provision of health care, and that includes everything from primary care through to substance abuse treatment for members of her family. It means improving the education opportunities that Dasani's going to have, who's obviously a very bright child and is getting some of the opportunities that she needs, but nowhere near enough. So it's about educational reform, it's about health care, it's certainly about housing, and it's really about the integration of those. Because nobody lives in one bureaucracy. Everybody in her position lives subject to many bureaucracies. And we need to figure out a way to see it from the family's perspective, not from the bureaucracy's perspective.
On one specific policy point related to that, do you believe, as the Bloomberg administration did, that if shelter families get priority for permanent housing or permanent housing vouchers, many families will move into shelters who would otherwise not, to jump the line?
Look, I think, is there always a risk of abuse of any system? Sure. Fundamentally, however, is there anyone who really believes that families opt to be homeless, that families opt to lose their own place to live, their own place of home and caring for their family so they can play a game with the housing system? Look, we'd be naive to say there aren't some people who abuse any system. But I think our basic belief is that homelessness is not a choice for most people. Homelessness is a dreadful condition that people fall into when the system fails them at one spot after the next. So it's not about punishing those who have fallen into that position. It's about giving them the tools to get out of that position.
Is that to say you would be likely to recommend going back to that policy that Mayor Bloomberg had and then ended about permanent housing priority for people in shelters, families in shelters in particular?
I think we'll be looking hard at all the resources we have to bring to bear on that, and that includes everything from our vouchers that exist, whether it's Section 8 or others, the creation of additional voucher programs, the allocation of existing housing units that the city controls. There's an array of those tools on the housing side. And then, as I mentioned, I believe these problems actually go beyond housing issues, and the city needs to find more comprehensive strategies for giving folks the support they need when they're in the middle of the kind of crisis that her family is.
On housing, I noticed that the mayor-elect introduced you as one of the architects of the Koch administration's affordable housing program, which was one of the greatest successes of that administration, I don't have to tell you. Does something about how you did it in the 80s apply today to get a couple of 100,000 more units as you want to do?
Well, look, times are different, and housing plans have to reflect the market conditions of the moment. And obviously, in many respects, New York's a much stronger city than it was many years ago, the city that Ed had to manage. I do think some of the challenges are the same, which really amount to making choices about where your resources are going to go. We can't do everything we want to do. We can't build all the housing we're going to need. So we're going to have to make some choices as to where we want to emphasize the growth. We know we have needs at every level. We have needs for homeless families. We have needs for other low-income families, working families, but that are having trouble making ends meet. And we have needs for middle-class families who are struggling to stay in a city that's become increasingly unaffordable for them. So finding the balance amongst all those, that was a challenge then. It's a challenge now. The market conditions are different now. We have some great opportunity in New York right now because it's a city that's in such demand, because the city's economy fundamentally has great strength to it. So I think there is some opportunity now that we didn't have back then.
That's so interesting.
But the challenges remain.
So when we were in hard times then after the 1970s fiscal crisis, you had to do much more with government expenditures. Tell me if I'm headed in the right direction here. Now you can do more more like mandatory inclusionary zoning because developers are there with money to spend. They want to build market rate housing. And so if you can get a requirement that like the city council, I understand, is going to consider as one of its priorities in the new year, affordable housing be included as a percentage of the units in any new development or any new development that asks for zoning variance, that things like that, more market rate oriented, are the opportunities for right now?
That's right, Brian. I mean, regardless of what the particular tools are, and there are lots of them, the point is if you're in a market when nobody wants to build, then the only way for construction to happen is for the government to support it. In a marketplace where lots of people want to build in lots of parts of New York, there's an opportunity to leverage that to achieve some of the objectives we have. And I'm hoping we'll find ways to be smart about that and take advantage of that momentum.
How far can you go with mandatory inclusionary zoning? Is it only if they ask to build higher than the current zoning allows in a particular neighborhood? Or is it for any new market rate development and you can say, look, you want to do this in New York, you have to include something affordable in the mix?
Well, look, it also varies by the nature of the housing that's under construction. We have to be careful about middle-income housing that's being developed, and the opportunities for, you know, shifting some of the benefit of that are different than for luxury housing. I think we're going to have interest in making sure that there's a spreading of the opportunity across the whole city. I think we want to make sure that there's opportunity for a diversity of people to live together, because that's always been one of New York's strengths. So I don't want to go down the road yet of articulating what that policy would be, Brian. I think that's early, and I think it's going to be relatively site-specific in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic notion here, which is that we're in a strong housing demand, we have a great opportunity to leverage that demand. There are a lot of tools that have been used across America to do that. We'll be looking at all of those.
My guest is the incoming first deputy mayor of New York City, Anthony Shoris. Let me touch a couple of other things with you briefly before you go. We have State Senate co-leader Jeffrey Klein coming up later in the program, whose group, the Independent Democrats, is proposing their own Affordable New York agenda, as they call it, for 2014. Have you coordinated with them or heard from them? Did they use you to help develop their statewide agenda at all, as far as you know?
I can't tell you that I know that, Brian. I know I haven't met with the senator or his team yet, so I can't tell you much on that. I haven't personally been involved in that.
What are the biggest couple of things that the state senate and assembly leaders could do in the 2014 session to support your and the mayor's goals for a strong middle class?
Well, I think we made pretty clear that our number one goal, that's an immediate goal, that we're going to be looking for support, and I think Senator Klein's offered that support already, is the universal pre-K after-school program that the mayor-elect proposed and that we need to have supported by a very marginal increase on the top end for the wealthiest New Yorkers in the personal income tax. That revenue stream to pay for that investment, which is, I think, one that has a very broad support across not only New York City, actually, but New York State, is going to require leadership from Albany, because it's not a tax that New York City can impose on its own. I think this will be a moment to call the question about everyone's commitment to universal pre-K, which everyone talks a good game about. Now's the time for everybody to see if they're ready to step forward. I think there's broad support for that everywhere, from the business community to the educational advocates and, frankly, the parents all across New York. We need the resources to do it. The ball's about to be handed to the legislature to make that happen. And I think Senator Klein's already indicated strong support for that. So we're looking forward to seeing more of that in the days to come.
Any number two agenda item that you might list?
I think there's no question we're going to need support from the state on a number of areas. Health care, I think, and the development of mechanisms to provide access to quality health care for people across this city, I think is going to require substantial state intervention. There's going to be an opportunity coming when the federal government, as I hope it will, grants New York State a what's called a Medicaid waiver that will create some additional funding. That will help New York achieve its objectives. I think the state will be a very important partner in making that happen. So on the healthcare agenda, on the education agenda, on the housing agenda, and ultimately, we just want to see New York treated fairly when it comes to the allocation of resources in the state. I think there's some progress that is left to be made there.
One thing on the healthcare agenda, if I could ask you about the job you're leaving as a top hospital administrator at NYU Langone Medical Center, an Affordable Care Act question.
Mm-hmm.
Many experts say it will fundamentally change how hospitals deliver care as, for example, reimbursement money flows from Washington under Medicaid and Medicare to discourage fee-for-service overutilization and instead pay hospitals for assessing community needs and keeping people healthy and outcomes and things like that. Do you see those levers in the law that would actually force change in the way hospitals deliver services in New York? And can they succeed at lowering health care inflation?
I think there's some evidence, Brian, that's already started to happen. The cost curve nationally has begun to bend a little bit. Some of that's for economic reasons and a slowed national economy. But part of it's actually the beginnings of the impact of the ACA. One of the key elements of the ACA, it's obviously mainly about access to health insurance, but there are a series of experiments included in the ACA, experiments around population-based health care, experiments around disease-based risk management by institutions. All of those are designed to change the model from one where physicians and hospitals are paid for every service they deliver to one where they're paid for the quality of the health care they provide. I think as those experiments broaden in their impact, and we've seen them start to happen in New York, they will change the behavior of physicians and hospitals and healthcare providers, and we hope eventually lead to people thinking about health rather than about disease-specific treatment. And if that is the case, then maybe America can begin to create a healthcare system that we can afford and be proud of.
Anything you want to say to the people of New York City as this transition moves toward Inauguration Day?
Only that it's a tremendously exciting moment for New York. I think we've got a mayor who's got an agenda as big as the city he's about to inherit. I think expectations are high. Our recognition of the realities is real. We know there's going to be some tough sledding ahead on fiscal issues, labor issues, risks associated with our budget. All of those have to be dealt with. But look, you know, there's an old sailor saying that you can't choose the winds, but you can set your sails. And I think this mayor has set his sails pretty clearly. There'll be some winds ahead, but I think we know where we're going.
Incoming First Deputy Mayor Anthony Shores, thank you so much. We look forward to speaking to you many times over the next 4 years.
Take care, Brian. Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Molly Ball from The Atlantic on an event called Ready for Hillary that she covered last week. And on the Senate and House Republicans weirdly trading places right now on which ones are the hardline conservatives threatening a year-end government shutdown. Stay with us.